Mr. Tyler, Reel 5. What exactly happened next after the Brussels, you know, during, this is a sort of period while you're waiting almost for the war to end, or the European war. What was the next move? There was a bit of a stalling after Arnhem.
Yes, there was, and of course it was really the crossing of the Rhine which held them up at that stage. I mean, after, of course, the Battle of the Bulge, of course, at one time I was shouting down the telephone from my telephone exchange, coming Bastogne, because we lost control of Bastogne for a time. But then the Rhine crossing was quite a major operation. Ironically, the division that I'd been in England before moving to my present unit, that's the 53rd Welsh Division, was one of the major divisions on the crossing of the Rhine assault. But it did take time to get that thoroughly established, and we didn't move on from Brussels until, I suspect, March 44, when we were pretty well moved straight up to Osnabrück, in other words, through Holland, which is not very wide at that point, into Germany, camped around Osnabrück, where there was a huge displaced persons camp. But of course, we were all astounded to see Germany, which had been very severely bombed, but enormous pains had obviously been taken to stack up, repair damage, or if not repair it, to keep the roads and things clear. And in a sense, we were very impressed with the way the Germans had kept things going during this very heavy bombing they'd suffered. No doubt, no being due to slave labour and what have you, but it did look very impressive as you drove through it. They'd obviously taken a tremendous amount of flak and assault and gone to enormous lengths to survive it. Osnabrück was probably the last place I was camped in before VE Day, which it would be May the 8th or 9th, 1944. And
do you remember any celebrations?
Yes, I remember. We had a sort of unit do in the canteen. I remember getting up, and I'm the sort of chap who tends, if there are speeches going on, so to speak, I'm the sort of chap who tends to make one. And I certainly made one on that occasion. I remember trying to tell a very feeble joke. I've never been good at jokes, but I don't think I was on that occasion. But, you know, we tried to talk about the future, and not in political terms, but obviously we felt we'd worked pretty hard to try and achieve this, even though we were not ourselves fighting troops. It was a very historic moment. And, of course, things moved very fast from then. The coalition government was dissolved, I think, 10 days after VE Day, replaced by a Conservative government, in which R.A. Butler was president of the Board of Trade, and it was he who introduced this Class B release system, which meant that those of us with awards at universities and things could get almost immediate release, although this, of course, didn't happen before the war against Japan had been concluded, but in terms of priority for release, this Class B status did give some of us with university places the chance to get back quickly and take them up. But of course, the next thing that happened to me was I was sent back to England, I believe, on something like the 31st of May.
You were flown back, weren't you?
In a Dakota from Lunenburg Heath, with my huge collection of Hansards that had followed me all the way across Europe from the invasion beaches, in an army ration box. And I think the election campaign lasted just over three weeks.
Now, so you got back now. Did you appoint the agent, or did the party appoint
him? Oh, no, the party appointed the agent.
And do you remember his name?
Yes. Oh, dear. He's come back to me at the moment.
Okay.
He lived in Warrington. It was right on the edge of... It was an absolute enormous constituency. It went from Warrington in the north. Well, didn't include Warrington, but part of Warrington in the north, part of the place called Bollington in the south, which is well to the south of Stockport. Absolutely huge constituency with just two small towns in it.
Very rural then?
Mostly villages, very rural. They'd never ever had a Labour candidate before. It had been run by the Liberals in 1906. But there was a Conservative candidate who was not the sitting member. He was Lieutenant Colonel Walter Bromley Davenport, a Liberal candidate who later became Lord Maitland, and a Commonwealth candidate.
Why was the Commonwealth candidate standing against Labour? I thought that.
Well, it was difficult for these people who'd been what I call the non-Labour. There was no rule that said that the members of Commonwealth had to be Labour Party members, obviously. So within Commonwealth, which was the medium through which opposition was given to Conservative candidates in seats which Conservatives had held and which Labour could not oppose under the rules of the coalition, this was the way in which it had been organised. Obviously, there were some people in it who were nothing to do with Labour, but who were opposed to the Conservatives and wanted to express that. Can't quite explain the whole process, but some of them found it was impossible not to go on fighting even when the political truce was ended and there were Labour candidates anymore. But this was not, even they were not a serious, they were not a serious. Never had any serious chance of getting a significant number of votes.
Now, how was the Labour Party organised in Knutsford? I mean, how many members did you have? And did it have any centres of strength, local councillors that it based itself around, or was it just...
No, I don't think there were any local councillors, as far as I know. Two towns, Knutsford itself and Wilmslow, two small towns, both very conservative. Apart from that, it was a chain of villages.
And how many members then, about?
I would have thought about 100.
For the whole constituency?
Yeah, I would have thought. Very difficult to be sure.
How was the election financed then? Because that must have been a problem with just 100 members.
I can't remember the detail. I suspect that the regional office probably played a very significant part. I mean, up in the north, regional office is the key organisational point. And our regional office, of course, is in the middle of Manchester. A fellow called Reg Wallace was the regional organiser. And his assistant was a Mrs. Kirby, I think, who actually tended to look after us. And Arthur Greenwood, although he was a Yorkshire seat rather than Lancashire, Cheshire seat, he was the sort of presiding guru over it all. But the Daily Herald used to come round and help us. They used to photograph me at factory meetings and that kind of thing.
So how was the campaign organised then? What did the agent organise? He would he tell you what to do, or would you?
Well, except what he wouldn't tell me to do. I mean, the extraordinary thing was you come straight back from the continent and you're immediately told you've got to write your election address.
He didn't write it for you then?
No, I don't know whether he sub-edited any of it, but I think I'd been, I think I'd even been drafting some bits and pieces while I was in Brussels. There may be something in here on it. Somewhere on there is my election address.
Right, I have here, I've got a copy of your general election manifesto. So right. Quite a substantial leaflet with headings, Planning or Chaos.
Can I just intervene? When I came back and went up to the constituency, my father had got me a car or something. Everywhere I went along the side of the road, the Conservatives had started their campaign with massive posters which just showed Winston Churchill's photograph and a simple inscription, Vote National. In other words, they were rather keeping off the word conservative and wanting to concentrate on the fact that Churchill had obviously won the war, was a good chap and should be re-elected. So my response to that, I don't think it's in the election address.
There is, Churchill is not the leader for peace.
No, but my great comment on this campaign of theirs about Vote National was, and I certainly had some leaflets on this, think national, be rational, vote Labour. That was my response to that.
Right, that's not in here. But the headings are basically a warning about the Conservatives, freedom, peace, working, we've won the peace, you know, international cooperation, this sort of stuff. And then a lot about industry and National Investment Board, nationalisation of almost everything. Not, you wouldn't fit into the modern Labour Party with this. And it's generally, and then as a forged signature, which your agent put on for you. And I noticed it's got his name on. It's H. Hodson, 100 Thelwall Road, Thelwall, near Warrington. That's Harry, did you say, or Harold?
Harold.
Harold Hodson.
Harold Hodson.
And so this is this leaflet. Quite, it must have cost quite a bit of money. And then there's another thing from the Labour Committee, again published by Hodson, your agent, which is just something introducing you, saying a bit of biography stuff. Tory private unenterprise, this sort of, we will put this in the files, and conservative alias national, I see that there, weighed in the scales and found wanting. That's the sort of thrust of that. So those are the two leaflets. Were they the only two leaflets you put out, do you think, or were there some other leaflets?
They would be the main ones. I mean, the interesting thing to me, in a sense, is the fact that I paid so much attention to the mess the Conservatives have made of it after the last war. You know, all this stuff about no wonder Baldwin's lips were sealed. It doesn't mean a lot at the moment, but one was trying to make the point they had a chance to sort things out after the last election. And then we're always very keen to quote Leopold Amory, who said, in 1924, we won our election on the Zinoviev letter, that we threw overboard all positive economic policy and left ourselves helpless in face of the growing evil of unemployment. In 1935, we won on a professed support of the policy of sanctions against Italy. To us in those days, the immediate post-First War election seemed much closer than it's hard to imagine at the moment.
I presume you thought it was relevant and you were just coming to another post-war.
Right, here we're coming to a post-war election. They're trying to say to the electorate, don't make the same mistake again.
Now, who would deliver it? I noticed from the your election address that it is set up, I think, to be folded as an election communication to be delivered by the Royal Mail.
Right.
Would that be how that went out?
Yeah, that would be free. That would be the one free delivery.
So that would be I presume your volunteers would hand address. No computers to do it in them days.
Oh, no.
And the other leaflet would presumably be delivered by your volunteers.
Yes, distributed at meetings or.
Did you do much leafleting of people's houses in those days? I mean, other than the one that
I don't think we did, because our resources, as you point out, were fairly modest. We didn't have very many members, although those that we did have were very enthusiastic. And there were strange straws. I mean, I knew that the army was pretty pro-Labour. And I knew how popular the Daily Mirror had been in the army. Not only did we get things like my Hansards came through the post, but newspapers were... We were getting newspapers very regularly in the army, national newspapers, and that was quite helpful. But none of us had any concept that there was going to be this huge defeat of Churchill, although, of course, we were very worked out about Churchill's Gestapo speech.
What was that? I don't know of that.
Ah, well, this is in the Times. In one of the broadcasts, Churchill said that in order to implement their policies of vast state control, etc., they would need a political Gestapo.
The Labour Party would.
The Labour Party would need to impose a sort of political Gestapo to ensure that their policies were universally enforced. Now there's something you could... There is the Conservative election address, which that makes it. But I've got...
This is Bromley Davenport.
Bromley Davenport. Now, Clem Attlee was very, very careful and well advised right. So... The hottest point of the election campaign was the Churchill Gestapo allegation. And this was, essentially, he was arguing that the fundamental conception of what he called the abject worship of the state struck at liberty in all its forms, and a complete socialist state could not afford to suffer opposition. A free parliament was odious to the socialist doctrinaire, and since no socialist government conducting the entire life and industry of the country could afford to allow free, sharp, or violently worded expression of public discontent, no socialist system could be established without a political police. They would have to fall back on some form of Gestapo, said Mr. Churchill, no doubt very handsomely directed in the first instance. And I'm quoting, by the way, from the Times... publication on the election of 1945 at that time. Now, Attlee's response was carefully worded. He referred to the Prime Minister as having been a great leader in war, under whom he had been privileged to serve, but said that by having given such a travesty of the policy of the Labour Party, Mr. Churchill had evidently wanted the electors to understand how great was the difference between Winston Churchill, the great leader in war of the United Nations, and Mr. Churchill, the party leader of the Conservatives. That was an absolutely devastating reply by Attlee, and I think everybody realised who'd won that particular exchange.
Now, looking here at you just handed me the Colonel Bromley Davenport's thing, and it does make a theme of strong support for Mr. Winston Churchill. Yes. If you want Winston Churchill as our Prime Minister, vote for me.
Yes.
And generally the, and then some rather interesting policy promises, which again I think we'll try and get a copy of this for election. Did the sort of remark that people were making? This is a remark in this election address about totalitarian monopolies result from nationalisation. Did this sort of language, which is obviously carrying with it direct or imputed comparisons with Nazi Germany, in other words, that you were a bit fascistic in your approach as socialist, did this really annoy you at the time, or did you just accept it as party political mudslinging?
Well, I was very surprised, because I had a great respect for Churchill, and I'd listened to all his speeches and that sort of thing. I mean, although I knew his... I mean, he always been weak on education, but then, of course, Rab Butler had come out with his Education Act in 1944, which was a pretty progressive act. So I was quite astounded, really, when we came out with all this stuff. And I feel here again, this is one of the enormous advantages Labour had from having been in the war cabinet. I mean, this idea that these chaps who've been running the war cabinet were suddenly going to start behaving like this, you know, I think just struck most people as fairly outlandish. I mean, no doubt some of them, the Tory supporters were a bit fired up, but none of us felt that this was any problem for us. We had our own problem. You may remember the Harold Laski affair.
Could you just comment on it?
When Churchill went to Potsdam, which was just before the election, in other words, Potsdam started at the end of June, he invited Attlee to go with him, Attlee being Deputy Prime Minister. So Harold Laski, then the chairman of the National Executive of the Labour Party, then published a statement saying that if Mr. Attlee accepted this invitation, he should only go as an observer, because otherwise he might be seen as having acceded to some sorts of agreements or undertakings or whatever, which had not been considered by the National Executive. I think you could assume that this didn't go down too well with right-wingers like me. And the whole Laski business was an awful nuisance because there was a libel action in which he was sued for libel. This dragged on for years and years. But Attlee gave some very sensible replies. He didn't accept any of these restrictions. But the two sort of exciting issues during the general election were, one, the Gestapo allegation by the Conservatives, and second, the National Executive constitutional matter raised in a very undiplomatic moment by our respected party chairman, who was a very bright but rather peculiar professor at the LSE at the time, you may remember.
Now, so we've discussed the leaflets. Now, you didn't do much actual direct leafleting of houses. I'll come on to public meetings later. Did they do what is now known as canvassing? In other words, knocking on doors, asking people how they're going to vote, and then on election day, knocking them up, so to speak, to make sure that they did vote. Did your agent organise that sort of thing, or was it not done?
I think there might have been some in Wilmslow, which was the biggest town. But I wouldn't have thought this went on in the villages, although, of course, there were attempts to visit houses and get, but I certainly wasn't involved in.
So you didn't do doorstep work?
Well, doorstep work would be more a matter of visiting known supporters in order that you'd been seen and that the people in the village had seen the candidate and you'd presented yourself and had a few discussions. It was rather more things like meetings reports.
Well, let's have a word about the meetings. Now, you've got a very impressive poster here.
I have to remember that.
Which is a list of public meetings, which Lieutenant F.L. Tyler. We haven't actually cleared up the name. You're known then as Frederick or Fred, F.L. Tyler. Pat's just your current nickname or name.
Well, that started at the age of 6 months. My grandmother said it's going to be far too confusing because my father was called Fred and I was called Fred. You're going to have to call him something else. And she decided he looks, let's call him Pat, she said. So in the family, I've always been known as Pat. At school, I was usually known as Watt. So, you know, my name has been a floating sort of object for many years.
So, but in this electorate, you were, I think, Fred, and in one of them, leaflets, yes. Frederick on that one, and F.L. Tyler. So this is impressive post, and it says the Labour candidate will speak Tuesday, June 26th, Victoria Hall, Holmes Chapel, Wednesday, June 27th, British Legion Hall, Wilmslow, Women's Meeting, Thursday, 28th, National Schools, Hanforth, Friday, 29th, Scouts Hall, Alderley Edge, Saturday, two meetings, one at British Legion Hall in the afternoon, Wilmslow, Style Schools, the other one. Tuesday, third, Victoria Hall. And then, then the big one, Wednesday, July 4th, Rex Borough. But the big rally was on July the 1st, on a Sunday, with the Right Honourable William Jowett and Mrs Kirby from the...
Can you...
So, I mean, the meetings were obviously very important. Now, it's strange, because meetings have gone now. They're just not held. What would these meetings be like? Or do you remember any of these that you can perhaps comment on?
Particularly exciting, of course, was this Rex Ballroom thing. Because it was packed, which was...
Now, what's packed? How many's packed?
I should have thought about 300.
Which would be a huge meeting now.
And... obviously, Sir William Jowett spoke. He'd been Attorney General or something 20 years ago.
And what was the thrust of his remarks? Or was he just introducing you, Bishop?
Well, no. He made a speech about nationalisation and these sort of things. Slightly old Labour, as you point out. No, but the great excitement was that I made the last speech. And I was saying the sort of usual things, and it was probably by then, you see, about 10 o'clock at night. And I suddenly saw a disturbance at the back. And because Bromley Davenport's a tall chap, you can see him pretty easily, and he came in. He'd obviously had his own meeting in Wilmslow, and he came in at the back of the hall. And so I was able to say something like, "And ladies and gentlemen, the task for us here in Knutsford is to make sure that we remove the Tory candidate, Colonel Bromley Davenport," and there he is, at the back of the hall. And everybody turned round and sort of went, boo! It was very extraordinary. No, I should never attend another public meeting quite like that.
Did people, would you make a speech? Would people ask questions?
Yes, although I can't remember much about it. But I do remember this amazing theme of the myth, one has to say, that the great bonus of a Labour government would be that all workers would work twice as hard. I mean, it may sound a little bit peculiar, but honestly, I've heard several people say it. You see, that under conservatism, exploitive capitalism, workers were working, but they were working, you know, they were kind of not stretching themselves too much. Once they had a government in whom they believed, all their productive enthusiasm would suddenly, you know, productivity would increase. So there were one or two nonsensical whimsies around, as well as sensible policies. So, you know, life isn't all strictly moderation, as you might say.
What about heckling? Just difficult members of the public or genuine members of the opposition heckling you? Did that occur much?
I don't recall it much up there.
Why had he gone to your meeting? It's very strange that he would present himself to be attacked, the Colonel, your opponent.
He was an amusing fellow.
Interesting that you were a lieutenant or second lieutenant.
He was a colonel. Yes,
was that did that cause any wrinkles?
No, I don't think so. I mean, he was 40 years old. It was more or less a function of our ages, broadly speaking. I got to know him quite well. And
did you appear at any joint meetings? Debates?
No, we didn't have any, but we were debating, if you like, in the local newspaper. But then his bits were written by his wife. That was the popular concept.